Red Crossfade. The Daily
Talk Show. A conversation sometimes worth recording with Josh Jensen and Tommy Jacket.
It's the Daily Talk Show live from West Hollywood, Los Angeles.
Yeah, with special guest Matt Diavella.
Hey, guys.
What's crack-a-lackin'?
Excited to be here.
It's when Tommy brings out his little vlogging camera. Yeah. I find it really hard not to just be super awkward.
Well, we had this.
I actually have a problem with that, too. When people put the Instagram story in your face.
Oh, yeah, from like 3 seconds into meeting.
That wasn't throwing shade again.
That wasn't an intentional reference.
So... You made the minimalism documentary, amongst other things. I can't speak. We just did an hour of your podcast.
Yeah. But it's the only thing people know me for.
We'll learn about you over this episode. But Josh and I were talking about vlogging and vloggers, and I guess I've become pretty comfortable holding a camera in a moment. But what we kind of realized is that while I might feel in the moment, it pulls people out of the moment. So it's this weird thing. Do you feel like if you were holding the camera, you were in the moment or out of the moment?
Well, I think there's two different styles of filmmaking. The one style was how I got started out, which is you're behind the camera. You are not part of the story. You're just capturing the story. So that is much easier, but you also have to help people be comfortable on camera. You don't just start filming, especially if you're shooting a doc. You want to kind of build rapport and build a connection with somebody before you put a camera in their face. The vlogging style is totally different because you are immersing yourself into it. You're turning the camera on yourself and bringing other people with you, which poses its own challenges. But I still think, and this is maybe an etiquette that a lot of people aren't picking up, at least the younger filmmakers, is that you should let people know if you're just going to come in filming, or especially if you have a big audience and you're reaching tens of thousands of people, that's like a lot to put on somebody in the moment without them preparing or really knowing what they're getting into. Yeah.
So do you think it's a rapport killer?
Is it a rapport killer?
We just want a headline.
Rapport killer, for sure. Yeah, no, I think it does. I think it hurts it a little bit because, yeah. I mean, that's why when I record any podcast, it's usually I'm meeting somebody for the first time. As cool as it would be to capture those moments of us meeting, I just don't want to be like, hey, by the way, when you get here, I'm going to start filming you right away. And then when you sit down, we're never going to have a moment where we're off camera being able to chat casually.
I think I've put my friends and family painfully through the process of becoming okay with it, because I think people know that I always have a camera on me nowadays. It's so hard because I've got so much out of approaching filmmaking from that angle to get comfortable and to get skilled in it. But yeah, it is at the detriment of, I haven't lost any friends, let's say that. But no, I am
haven't
more.
Haven't gained any either, right?
Yeah. I've had the same, hang on, when I picked up the camera, I've got not, yeah, exactly the same friends.
Do you feel that when you tell guests that they're going to be filmed, have you ever had a moment where they've said, I don't want to be doing video?
No, but I have had people show up and be like, oh, you're doing video?
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that's just one of the things where I am not the best at communicating.
You're doing a great job now. Like the way that you said that slowly. It's like
pretty
my
good,
therapist
right?
said that I just need to talk slower.
That's how, that's my punchy comedic voice. but I sometimes don't fully communicate and let people know exactly what they're getting into. Like you can't curse on the, or you can curse on the show and what you can and can't do. And is there anything you don't want to talk about on the podcast? There's certain things that I think are helpful for guests when you let them know, letting them know they're going to be filmed and on camera. I've said a couple of times where like they're coming up and I'm like, oh yeah. Like I think I mentioned, by the way, that, you know, I film all of this, and they're like, oh, do I not look like I'm ready to be on camera?
Yeah, sure.
So I stopped doing that.
Yeah. What do they say? Assume to make an ass out of you and me when you break it down. It's like if you assume that they know, you end up looking bad, they look bad. And so, yeah, I guess in these situations, over communicating.
Do you have like an email template, like not to template shit, but do you actually have sort of a few words that you just copy and paste so you know that you're communicating that stuff each time?
No, and I should. That's probably one of those things that's like, it would save me a lot of time. but it kind of happens naturally in the ask, because I get most of my guests through asking through email. So I usually have certain things where I will actually say in the first email, you know, it is filmed slash recorded at my apartment in West Hollywood, which, but a lot of people forget that because it's in the first email that you ever exchange with somebody. So it sometimes goes to reiterate that to make sure that they're just aware of it and comfortable with it.
Do you feel like you're the podcast guy now? Because like when we first started chatting online, you didn't even have your podcast. So how has things changed since you've started?
Well, it's funny. When we first met in person was January of 2016 or 17.
So cute. Yeah, I remember.
Maybe 17.
17. And yeah, right. Because my documentary, I think, came out just the year prior recently. And I was in this mode of starting to build something to create original content. The podcast started 3 months after that. So I haven't become known as the podcast guy. If anything, it's the YouTube guy. Mm-hmm. When I started out, I didn't intend to be a YouTuber, but then people started calling me a YouTuber. So I said, oh, okay, I guess that's what I am now.
YouTube t-shirt.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. You cannot see, but I am wearing my YouTube t-shirt.
Yeah. What about, and he's got his play button on the wall. What about being a filmmaker? Is there a point where you felt like, I can't say I'm a filmmaker? Well, no one really can unless they use film for the technical sense of the world.
That's changed a bit. You know what's funny though is like my parents used to call me a videographer.
Oh yeah.
Which is
you haven't spoken to them since.
Yeah. That's the biggest slight jab and they didn't even realize it.
I mean, you were doing bar mitzvahs. So it's like, you're like,
there was a transition point where I was doing actual film.
Could you call yourself a filmmaker and be doing bar mitzvahs? Yeah. I wonder if those.
And you had to wear the yarmulke while you're filming.
Yeah. People call it, it doesn't really matter. It's really what makes you sleep better at night.
Yeah.
I think calling yourself, that's where the element of branding is sometimes helpful, where I think if you call yourself a filmmaker and you make films, you're maybe elevating it a little bit, where if you call it, you're making videos, clients, it may not look as professional to clients.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I even noticed when I first started Full Stack Films, I was really into talking about filmmaking and storytelling, but it doesn't necessarily translate. Like clients want a video. They don't want to film in a lot of ways. Mm. I wonder if that's going to change. But as soon as I changed it to video production company, it started getting a different type of audience.
So how did the audience change when you did video production?
Well, I think that I actually gained an audience through search engines.
Like, I think so, yeah.
Like no one searched for, like people who search for Melbourne filmmakers aren't the people who are spending corporate dollars to get videos made.
This is the difference between somebody who's an artist who gets too attached to maybe the name of something. It needs to sound artistic and symbolic. Mm. When if you labeled your video something like how to wake up early, it's going to get a lot more people's attention because you're actually figuring out what people are searching for, what they would be looking for, as opposed to creating a really clever name.
I think titles help people out. I know the videos I've made that have got media attention, I've noticed like people grab or go to somewhere to just pull a title because they need that then helps them write something. Like I've had entertainer written up about me. I had fitness guru.
It was a PT once.
And a crappy one at that.
Yeah.
And then lately I've managed to that always go for filmmaker. And sure enough, it's for myself, but it's also like if there's one shot, what do I probably want? And that is for someone then to call me a filmmaker.
Yeah. But I guess the good thing about it is that you can create your own labels for yourself. And some people would be so averse to kind of doing it, just creating any labels. Yeah. Like, I don't like labels.
I don't like time. I don't believe in time.
Then why have you got a watch on?
Yeah. Some people would not like to even define things.
Yeah.
And that can be a challenging way to live. But to create labels for yourself, I think, is empowering in a lot of ways because then you define the way people start talking about you. Sometimes you have no control over it. People might call you an entertainer, even though that's not what you do. People always call comedians funny man.
Funny man. Right? It's to bring them down a bit because the person's not funny that's saying
really,
it.
Actually, we noticed that it was really nice to be able to tell people that with our podcast that we're not comedians. Mm. And this is, like, there's a lot of comedians who are doing podcasts, and we've had some comedians on the show recently in LA. And I think that they change, like, the comedians change when we explain, oh, like, we're not comedians. I don't know if, I guess it's just because they don't have to worry about us trying to be
competing.
Funny or competing.
Yeah, I think it maybe takes some of the pressure away too. Yeah. There's a huge trend of comedians doing podcasts, and it is, I mean, it's kind of difficult in terms of the saturation. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you guys worry about at all? It's like the fact that so many people are doing it and getting into the space.
We've just said we're lucky we did the 5-day a week thing daily, because now we've got nearly 200 eps.
Yeah. If we hadn't done that, then we would, it'd be a lot slower, I think.
It's kind of amazing. Just, I mean, the fact that you've done so many, because most people, they wouldn't even look and see, oh, you know, you do 5 episodes every week. Yeah, they would just see
the final,
wow, one. These guys have been doing this for a very long time.
I've literally seen people who, I've only just found their podcast, and they're at, say, 280 episodes, and you look and they've been doing it for years. And so I think that doing it daily is giving us, I don't think that we would be putting the energy that we're putting in the podcast now, or have the excitement, if we weren't doing it every single weekday.
Yeah. How many videos are you making a week now, Matt?
I do a video every Monday for my YouTube channel, which is anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes.
And they're seriously thoughtful videos that take a bit of time.
Well, that was a big learning lesson for me. But just to answer your question, like, I do podcast Monday, and I do video on Monday, podcast every Wednesday, and then I used to do an extra video on Fridays, but then it just became too much and not sustainable. But I also do create secret videos for my Patreon, patreon.com/MattTiavella. You guys do this on my podcast.
Yeah, I like it. Secret videos sounds so sleazy though. It sounds like you're doing like...
But it's dirty. It's very raw and uncensored. So what I learned early on was, like, I wasn't even a YouTube consumer. I didn't watch a lot of YouTube videos. And obviously I had heard of Casey Neistat, but that's like it. I couldn't have listed out, like I can now, 15 other YouTubers that are making content consistently.
What were you consuming?
I would listen to podcasts, but I wouldn't watch them necessarily.
What would you listen to?
Listen to Tim Ferriss, Joe Rogan, a lot of the main ones, Freakonomics. Mm-hmm. I like some of the edited podcasts. Malcolm Gladwell came out with an amazing podcast. Yeah, Revisionist History. But what I did consume on YouTube was Joe Rogan clips. And then, so that's what I thought YouTube was. It was just a collection of clips. And if I put excerpts of my my podcast on YouTube, then I would get a lot of people finding me, and those videos would get hundreds of thousands of views, and my podcast would take off. And I did that for a year, where I put out maybe 2, sometimes 3 excerpts a week, which is a lot less work. You're just cutting it out, exporting it. It takes a little bit of work to color and do all that stuff. But I just saw no traction at all. And then when I started to make these short form videos about simplicity, minimalism, well-being, and mindfulness, then they started to take off, because it was just, like you said, it was like more, I put a lot more thought, time, and energy into one video a week, as opposed to just easily uploading 3 videos a week.
It was interesting. I noticed that my viewing habits with your content was, when I saw the small clips and I saw the thumbnail of the person, I wouldn't click on those. When it was an idea that had a nice image, I'd click on that, or I would only click on the thumbnails of the people if it was the full length. Like, if I saw it was like an hour long, I'm like, okay, I'll consume that whole bit, because it's almost like you can end up doubling up on things, right? And so it's that balance of, what are people actually going to watch? Are they going to watch the full length, or are they going to watch like the little snippets?
It is a balance of, I think there's 2 different kind of creators on YouTube. At least if you were going to put it into 2 buckets, I would do the YouTuber who is... most of their views come from subscribers, people who subscribe and they want to see every video you release. Well, if you're doing the other model, which is just mass uploads every single day, you're putting up an excerpt or something really quick and easy. Yeah. People aren't going to, the quality isn't there, first of all. And then also it's just, there's so much going out there that people can't even keep up with it. Mm. So I think that there is a detriment to actually putting out too much stuff.
So you're annoying. You're a person that wasn't consuming YouTube and now has over 200,000 subs.
Yeah.
And there's people out there going, fuck, I just want to be a YouTuber and I've got no subs. Like, what do you think the breaking it down now? Like you said, there's a little strategy around what you did, but do you think there's something in it that you weren't a big consumer and you kind of didn't, you weren't sort of jaded or had some thoughts about how it's working for someone else?
It probably helped because I think what helps is doing something different. And to do something different requires you to be able to not be trapped in the bubble, because it's very easy to do the daily vlog, you know, and just do that every single day. And in a lot of ways, you're just kind of mimicking what other people are doing. But then to be able to tell a story in a different way, a lot of times it just comes through in personality. So that might not matter what the medium is or how you're telling a story, because your personality is going to be different. And for me, it was finding a topic that people were interested in and being very focused and specific about that. So the creativity type stuff didn't really do that well in the beginning. But then when I started to talk about minimalism and simplicity, it started to resonate more. And then what you have to do is just react to how people are reacting to your videos. So I put out my minimalist apartment, and it was just an apartment tour showing how I live as a minimalist, but really just showing how it might be just like anybody else's apartment, but with just a little bit less stuff. I added some humor to the video. It wasn't dull and dry. And I think sometimes with minimalism content online, people just take themselves, and self-development in general.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything is so serious. Everything, it's like, and that's not how I wanted my content to show up. I wanted to actually make something that had my personality in it, so then my friends couldn't make fun of me. Because if I pretended to be, Joe Rogan or Tim Ferriss or somebody that I'm not, people just make fun of me and be like, dude, what are you doing? Like, why are you making that voice?
I think that's like a really good point. I know Hamish Blake talks about it with Andy Lee, with Hamish and Andy, where Andy went to a school that like all boys school, and his benchmark was avoiding to be made fun of. And so like that's the filter in which they go through a lot of their content, which is probably, it means that you're really tapped into not taking yourself too seriously.
You have to. I think that's one of the biggest things I learned early on, just as a person in the world, was to be self-deprecating. Because oftentimes when you're a teenager, you take yourself way too seriously. And if somebody makes fun of you, it just crushes your ego. Yeah. But then you make fun of yourself one time and people laugh. And it maybe kind of hurts a little bit more than it should, because it's the first time. You're like, oh, people were making fun, laughing at me. But it's at my own expense. Yeah, yeah. So there's a control in that. And I think that learning that, I think people would be so much happier if they just weren't so serious all the time.
When do you think you should double down on talking about your success?
Right now.
Yeah. Yeah, you're on a podcast.
No, but what do you mean, though?
So I think my observation of Americans are that they celebrate their success. And I've seen Australians, we feel, I can't talk for all of Australia, but my observation is that, like you said, be self-deprecating. You don't need to go out there yelling from the rooftops. But when do you feel like you should, do you even think about, are you okay with talking about the success you've had, or do you steer away from it as a person? Is that naturally you?
Yeah, it's kind of like the art of the humble brag.
Yeah, yeah.
I think sometimes it's good to soften it with a joke. And be like, no, but seriously, like actually this is how it happened. Because I think it's helpful for people to learn from the mistakes that you've made. And I think luckily that is easier to talk about, because it's like, well, I tried this, this, and this. It didn't work, but then this did work. And I think that's a humble way to talk about success. I just wouldn't want to be the kind of person that nonstop talks about my own success or brags too much. There is an element of making noise that is helpful in any field. Like say if you're working a 9-to-5 job and you have done well on a project, but you're not getting recognition that maybe you deserve, I think it does help to make a little bit of noise and let people know, let your boss know what you're working on. There was, I think it was in a Malcolm Gladwell book, but they put out he talked about the story where they put out a dishwasher and it was just no hum, no sound. It was super quiet. And people had this installed in their house and their apartments, and they thought it was broken because it was so quiet.
Yeah.
So the manufacturer ended up adding a light hum to it to let people know that it was working.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that's what we have to do in our own work. Just let people know a little bit, but also don't be a dick about it.
It's like toothpaste, like the foaming agent is like designed because it's like, it feels like it apparently doesn't really do much for cleaning your teeth.
The tingle as well.
Yeah,
the mint tingle, because it gives you like that trigger at the end. And I think that was the example with Febreze. Yeah. They were trying to figure out how to sell Febreze, and people that live in smelly houses don't know it.
Yeah.
They're amongst.
I was about to tell you, Matt. No, your house smells amazing.
I got the candle here from Australia.
Yeah, it's great.
But they don't know it, so they're not as incentivized to actually use the spray.
Yeah.
But then they started to market it as, after you clean your house, then you do that as like a nice finishing touch. It's like almost like a reward for you. Yeah. And yeah, that's the end of that sentence.
It's dry Febreze.
You know, you clearly talk very well. Did you give stand-up comedy a go?
Yeah, I did actually. I did stand up for about like 8 months or so.
Fuck, that's a decent.
How many gigs in 8 months?
I couldn't tell you, but I did a lot of open mic. I mean, it was all open mic nights.
Yeah.
I never got paid to do it, but one of my buddies, Nate Jaiola, he actually went on to do stand up comedy in Vietnam and Cambodia. There's a big expat community there. And he got me to do it because I had been writing jokes for a year.
Yeah.
And it was just a dream, a crazy idea that I always wanted to do stand up, at least just get on stage once. Mm. But I never thought I'd do it. And I met him in a comedy workshop class in college. And he's like, yeah, I just did stand up for the first time like 3 weeks ago. You should totally do it. So I was like, all right, I got all these jokes. And he just convinced me to go and do it. And it was brutal. Anybody who's ever done stand-up will tell you that the first time, very unless you're Dave Chappelle, the first time you get on stage is just awful, but there's kind of a thrill to actually doing it. And then I just pretty consistently, you know, every week or two, I would get up and go into Center City, Philadelphia, tell jokes to drunk people at a bar.
And that's how it works.
That's how it works. And then getting a little bit of success with that too, and seeing, and also it did teach me about not expecting anything from an audience, because Thursday night I would do stand up and I would just kill it. I remember one time I would do like these like one liners, and it was kind of just set up punchline, kind of like Dimitri Martin. And cause I would like play guitar as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But then there was this one guy, like the host of the show was like, I'm sorry, but like there was a dude at the back of the room that almost died from laughing so hard. And that felt great. And then on Friday, I did the same exact jokes to a crowd that I thought would have been better because they were young and college aged. Yeah. And it was crickets.
Yeah. Oh, no.
It was the worst I'd ever bombed.
And he was like, there was nearly a guy dying from silence.
Like, you guys don't know me. But it was a learning lesson to say that, you know, you can't.
It's them, not me. Fuck
it's them, not me. You can't imagine. Some people just aren't into it.
Yeah. Mm.
Some people just don't think it's funny. And it's not your job to judge an audience based on how they react.
Was there a difference in what you did, do you think, on those two nights?
I want to say it was close to identical.
Yeah.
And I think other comedians will tell you that. It's just whatever it is, it's a mysterious aspect to it. It could be the age of the crowd. It could be the night. It could be, you know, just the people who led up to them. Up to you performing could have been really bad and didn't warm up the crowd enough. A lot of things would go into
When was your last gig?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I can't even remember the specific gig that I did.
Well, what was the specific moment of being like, I'm not fucking doing this again?
Yeah, yeah.
It was actually kind of hard. It was a really tough decision because I loved comedy, and that was really what got me into film originally. But I was doing film and comedy at the same time. And I didn't have one focus where I was kind of splitting my time between the two of them. And I felt like I had to commit because my mind was always running, thinking of jokes and trying to write jokes and invest my energy into how can I grow my comedy, you know, career. But then I was starting to make money as a freelance filmmaker, being in debt $100,000 in student loans. And I was like, maybe I should just, you know, I have a passion for filmmaking and I'm also making money. Why don't I just put all my energy into that? So that's what I did.
Yeah. Being in LA, does it make you see the comedy scene and think maybe I'll have another crack?
Well, no. I mean, it actually, because I have some friends who I made a lot of great friends who still do comedy to this day from back in the day. Some of them successful, some of them still working to get open mic nights. And it's like, it's a grind. You have to do comedy 5-6 nights a week. And it takes a lot because there's so many people doing it that I think there's other avenues to getting to that place where even now in my YouTube videos, I've turned it, a lot of it into just joke writing.
Yeah.
I'm in my videos. I'm like, all right, I'm going to do a video about minimalism and how it influences my workout routine. I cannot take myself seriously in this video. How many jokes can I just throw into this? And actually, it's a lot easier to get away with a joke on YouTube because you don't have to deliver it in front of a crowd. You can pace it. You can figure out whether it's actually going to work or not. And sometimes just being a little bit odd and silly works on YouTube when if you did it in front of a crowd, they would be like, this guy's a loser.
Yeah, weird unit. Because I look at... I'm in the filmmaking industry. I look at musicians and I think, oh, look at that. That would be such a slog. Do you think it's just because I love filmmaking enough that it's something that I can, it is a competitive industry. And so it's like, I'm amongst it. So I can, and I love it enough that I can deal with that competitive nature of it. And I don't love music enough. And that's why I'm not in it. For you, like comedy, looking at that, do you think it's because you didn't love it enough and you liked filmmaking more that you stuck at it?
Some industries and jobs are easier to get into. Mm. And I think that there are many, many, like, I couldn't even imagine how many more full-time freelance filmmakers and photographers there are over full-time freelance comedians.
Yeah.
Like, it must be, you know, 1,000 to 1. Yeah. It's got to be crazy. So, you know, you have a choice too, and you could, I fully support people. If you want to just go after the dream and wholeheartedly put everything you have into it, go for it. But know that you could be happy. This is like one of those hard things where I'm like, don't follow your dreams. But there are some more practical ways to do it. And then you could always do comedy down the road. Yeah. You could always do these things in other ways where maybe it's not pursuing acting. Maybe it's pursuing directing. And then when you become a successful director, then you could then parlay that into directing films that maybe you yourself act in.
Yeah. I mean, you're living the modern filmmaking dream by being one of the few people who have been able to sell something to Netflix. What was that experience like?
That wasn't the goal in the beginning. The goal was just to make a documentary. You know what I mean? I think that is a dream for a lot of people.
Yeah. But I think that maybe I actually think that whilst that's the case, the conversation, unfortunately, I think there's more people who are like, how do I get something on Netflix than how do I make a doco?
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that crazy? I mean, I think that's the same thing as people on YouTube who say, how do I get 100,000 subscribers versus how do I make amazing films? And different mentalities. I mean, I think probably if you look at how you guys started and how I started, it wasn't as much based upon what other people thought of it.
Yeah.
I made VHS tape home movies, like thrasher thriller movies with my brothers and sisters. And there was no audience. There was no, ooh, then I could get a certain amount of subscribers on YouTube. It was so fun just to tell a story and to be able to take these two frames that were shot, you know, 2 hours apart from each other and then stitch them together. And then there's a story there. And it actually, it starts to make sense. And then actually gets a reaction out of your family and friends. When they watch it, they laugh.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing to focus on is like, first try to do it with intentions of just maybe telling a story that you're passionate about and you really care about. And then once you make the thing, whether it's a short film or a feature, then I think it's definitely time to think about, all right, how can we actually sell this? Yeah. But it has to be great first.
Are people having pipe dreams about this sort of thing? Like the conversations, because you have done it, are there a lot of people seeking that? And what have they got wrong in the conversations that you've had with them?
Well, I would say that if somebody wants to have a successful film, and I would say a successful film is something that makes you money back, that like you could actually turn into a career. So my expectations were, or at least my hopes and dreams of making minimalism was that we'd make our money back that we put into it, which isn't the highest bar. But for my first film, I was totally fine with it. I was like, well, it'd be really cool if we can get the word out there and this, you know, people could get some value from the film. And if I made the 10 grand I put into it back, I'd be thrilled. I'd be stoked. But then after we made it, I was like, oh no, I like doing that. I want to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. So I need to make more than just my money back. Yeah. You know what I mean? If I wanted it to be a job, yeah. I need to actually make a living doing it. So it, the advice that I would give is find a partner or two. And you guys have talked about this too, how like you wouldn't have been able to do the podcast without each other because it helps to motivate you. That's one thing that helps having a partner. The one is if the partner also has an audience. So
now we're fucked.
Yeah,
exactly. Who's bringing the audience?
Yeah, this is why we've got you here, Matt. Yeah. Exactly. We've seen you 200,000 plus.
Yeah. So it's you have to, if you find a partner that you can work with like that, then they have their audience. You're also bringing your filmmaking expertise, and then the two together can actually create something that doesn't need Netflix.
Yeah.
And that's something that we knew from the beginning is that, well, no matter what, we could release this to your audience and 5,000 people might see it. 1,000 people might buy it. And that was enough for us. It gave us a lot of confidence going into it that we're not actually just spinning our wheels.
Has it changed when it's got on Netflix? Have you had those thoughts and had to remind yourself that, okay, maybe it's not about the Netflix thing? Have you been, is there a trap that you've fallen into?
No, I could see that. And, but I mean, I'm like I said, I'm kind of self-deprecating as it is, and maybe I don't have enough confidence, but I'm like, yeah, there's no way I'm going to get back on Netflix or like
maybe go on Crackle. What was the one?
Yeah, maybe I'll get Crackle.
Comedians in Cars had, and then all of a sudden that's gone from there. And they fucking Sony Crackle emails me like every second day from signing up once to watch Comedians in Cars.
They're still doing it. They're still trying to make it work.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a thing.
No, it's not going to be a thing. They could do something Crackle though.
Yeah. It doesn't really play in my mind. Actually, that was one of the reasons why I decided to go on YouTube, start a podcast, create my own audience, because it was, to me, self-reliance.
Mm.
It was, I don't need Netflix. I don't need somebody else's audience. I could, if I have an idea for something, I could make a movie and I could put it out there. And even if in the beginning it's small, it's something that I could build upon. And it would be amazing to get to the point where you wouldn't even need a Netflix. You could just make something yourself and put it out there.
Do you think modern day filmmakers need to step out from behind the camera and into in front of the camera to, you know, elevate their brand, elevate their skills, like what you've done?
I guess it like depends on what kind of goals that they would have and what they want to get out of it. I think
just to make it in this landscape.
To make it, it doesn't hurt, but not everybody's made for that. Mm. So there are a lot of people that I think they could provide just as much value just staying behind the camera. Not everybody looks like they should be on camera too. But I think you have to figure out what you like doing. If you enjoy being in front of the camera, and sometimes it takes a while to actually get comfortable in front of it and put in the time to see, then I think that's probably something that would help you down the road. But if every time you turn the camera on yourself, it's a grind and you hate it. And like, I mean, I have those moments, but all in all, I'm like, it's worth it for me to put in the work. Then, you know, it may or may not be for you.
We've had friends who have had videos that they've made go viral, and they've all of a sudden gained an audience specifically based on that style of video that they've done, and they've sort of been locked in. What's been the learnings for you having done minimalism and gaining a sort of audience? What have you had to think about in regards to identity and personal brand?
Yeah, well, I know that whenever I make a video on my YouTube channel about minimalism, if minimalism's in the title, it's about simplicity, it's going to do 4 times better than anything else I put out.
Mm.
That's something that I know just from releasing a certain amount of videos. But then it doesn't mean that I can't talk about other stuff. It means I have to be creative in transitioning to that kind of content. And I think what I want people to eventually just come for me, because I add humor in my videos or because the way I tell stories or the topics I cover, they might come to me for a bunch of different reasons. But then even this past week, I made a video about how I make my videos, which I was like, well, this is probably not going to do as well, but I did see in some of the comments, people being like, hey, I do not care about filmmaking at all, but I found this really interesting, or this was like, I thought this video was really funny or entertaining. And I think that's what I try to get through. But a lot of people get known for one thing. Like Gary Vee started out as the wine guy.
Yeah.
And then now he's an entrepreneur. The Rock You guys know I love The Rock.
Yeah.
He started out WWE and now he's a huge movie star. And the points of transition, a lot of people are going to like say, that's not going to work out. Like that. What are they doing? Like they should stay in their own lane. And then you can make it work. It's not guaranteed.
Yeah. Is there a friction to it? How do you like push against what the audience are trying to, or if you know that you're going to get more views doing the minimalism stuff, I'm guessing it can be sometimes hard to be like, if I'm going to put in 10 hours and I know that I'm going to get more views if I do minimalism content, I guess it can be pretty sort of enticing just to do minimalism stuff.
Yeah, I think it would get a little bit boring.
For the audience?
For me, if all I did was minimalism content. But also it does take an element of just getting creative with it, because maybe it's that I just haven't really, there's probably 100 other minimalism related videos lightly based around that topic that I could just have so much fun with and explore. So I don't think, like we were talking about on my podcast about like Seth Godin, it's like, does he run out of ideas to talk about? Like, no, he's always going to have ideas.
He's fucking Seth Godin.
He's never going to run out of ideas. And that's the same thing with even a topic as narrow as that. That said, I find it interesting to talk about other aspects that are lightly related. So I've got a video in the works about waking up early. Like what are the certain steps that help me to wake up early every single day?
So it's fucking alarm clock, isn't it?
It's an alarm clock. It's step one, alarm clock. Step two, wake the fuck up.
That was a Jocko Willing podcast.
Take a photo of your sweat on the ground. Willing. Things like that are related to well-being, and there's so many other things that I would be interested in that I could cover there. And I think what also helped me too was having the podcast early on, which is really just about creativity, sometimes about simplicity as it applies to creativity. But that has been an outlet for me to talk about whatever I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. It's a combination of all the things you're doing that I guess has got you to where you are. Is there one that is the main love or the main passion?
I think it always comes back to filmmaking. Like I really do enjoy the process. I, even through minimalism and everything I've done, I've had hands on everything from filming it, editing it, color grading it, all that stuff. Sometimes I'd get help like with minimalism. My buddy colored it, but I love editing and I love the storytelling and the challenges that come from being in an edit. And I find it hard for me to detach myself from that. Yeah. So imagine growing to a point where you could hire somebody to shoot and edit all your videos. There is an element to the blogger or the writer that has a website and gets popular for their own writing. And then they get so big that they just start hiring people to write articles for them and for their site. It's like, there's a disconnect there where I'm like, filmmaking is an art form, and it's your voice comes through in how you tell those stories. And I don't think as many people would follow Casey Neistat if he had somebody following him around with a camera, shooting and editing everything.
Do you think you've created a beast that you can't control and that you have to constantly be giving content and new videos to?
Yes. I think that's one of the unexpected things that happens when you start creating original content. Because I originally did it because I thought I'd have more freedom. You know what I mean? Where when I was doing client work, I actually had way more time in the day.
Well, it's almost, I think what happens is that people leave their 9-to-5 job because they don't want a boss. Then they get clients and realize that they've got a fucking 100 bosses. And now you've got the interesting perspective that Tommy and I don't necessarily have yet, which is, what is that next stage to creating original content? Is it like having 10,000 bosses?
Well, 200,000 bosses.
Josh is a Patreon subscriber. He's your boss.
Yeah, so I'm a shareholder. I love what you've done with the blog.
I did call you guys out in my recent AMA, end of the recent AMA podcast. Amazing. I told people to go check out your podcast.
Hey. Oh,
thank you. If you're listening.
Yeah.
Thank
it was actually going to be a test to you, because I said in the podcast, I was like, Josh, if you're listening to this, like we'll find out. But
I'm the only one that looks like a tight ass for not supporting Matt now.
Yeah, you son of a bitch. I'm a patron of myself.
Yeah, how many people do you actually support on Patreon? Yourself?
I don't support anybody. Yeah. But it's the same thing as like, I don't watch many documentaries, you know? Yeah. I don't listen to many podcasts anymore because I'm creating a lot.
Because funnily enough, like I think that I've
as a supporter of whatever it is that's happening right now, I don't completely understand how this monetization thing's going to work for a lot of people, especially smaller podcasters.
Oh, yeah.
But people who are doing Patreon, like I got rid of a bunch of subscriptions that were costing me a bunch of money and said, okay, I've got $100 a month and I'm going to use this as like my fund where I'm just going to support a bunch of people who are doing cool shit as an idea of like, we'll see what happens, see where this goes.
It's kind of amazing. And I mean, I think it's becoming more and more acceptable. I mean, some people will be like, well, I have the videos. If you want to pay for like the top tier, it's $12 a month.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are like, Matt, that's what I pay for Netflix. Yeah. Why would I pay you $12 a month for a couple videos every month when I have all this content on Netflix? And I'm like, I don't have an answer for that. Because you really care about me and you like the fact that I don't advertise.
Do people actually say that? Have people said that to you?
Yeah, yeah. In the comments, people are like, oh, it just doesn't make sense. Like, why would I ever pay for that? But I get it. It makes sense. But that's actually not what we're comparing.
Yeah. What's the mindset shift then? That people have to, like, who is paying the, like, what are they getting out of it or how are they viewing life that maybe the person who thinks that it's a far stretch?
I think it does go to like the 1,000 true fans, is that those are the people that really care about you and want to support your work. And I think many of them have more flexible incomes. They're making a little bit more money. They actually do little exit interviews on Patreon so you can see why people are leaving, which I just found out about yesterday. Cool. And I was really nervous when I was going in there.
How many people did you have? Because I'm guessing when you start something like Patreon at the very beginning, you're going to end up with a higher drop-off rate because people are entering it probably to see whether it's worth it. And then they do it for the first month and then they drop off.
But I think then you have a balance of two people that just forget. Yeah. Like, I mean, how many things have you signed up for that you forget?
I literally found out,
this is hilarious.
Like a week ago, Bree was looking at our bank statements. It turns out that I had Netflix, the American Netflix since 2011. And
and the Australian.
But there was a point where the VPN stopped working. Like you couldn't use the VPN anymore when it came to Australia, but I'd still been paying. So I've spent about, I think, $400 on a Netflix login that we haven't accessed.
Wow.
So I don't know if we're going to be able to get that back. Well,
if you said that Netflix have 1% or 3% of people doing that, they're making a lot of money.
Well, it's the whole gym membership model.
Yeah.
How many people are just making a killing owning gyms when only 40% of people actually show up?
Well, if all members went at once, it'd be chaotic. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was saying to Tommy. I reckon like I've actually funded a bunch of original Netflix series through my subscription I didn't even know about. Yeah. I'm sure that's the same with gym. I'm sure I've paid a fair few leases at gyms.
Yeah. I was going through the exit interviews. I think I have to count, but it might be 30 people that signed up, maybe 40, I don't know, that have signed up and exited out. Probably would get at least 15 every month. And a large majority of them, almost every single one, would just say financially, you know, they did it for financial reasons because they were trying to save money. Then there was maybe three out of the group that was like
not getting value,
content not what expected.
Oh, really?
Content creator did not deliver. And I wanted to sit that person down and say, listen, motherfucker.
You were like, I think I was telling Tommy before we got here, I think you are doing Patreon the best in the sense of it's not like you're some people were doing it where they were doing video content and audio, and then they took away something from their audience and said, well, you can only access video if you support me on Patreon, which what I like about what you've done is you're using a new muscle with the vlogging type of stuff. And I actually see like real value in seeing that behind the scenes type of content.
Yeah. So it was like, I had never done any vlogging really. Most of my videos would be more doc style or me sitting down talking to the camera, but not where you're holding the camera and maybe showing like a vacation type vlog or anything that you would
being
do.
Being obnoxious.
You're so obnoxious. Natalie loves it. I knew I wasn't good enough yet, or I never even wanted to do that as part of my actual YouTube channel.
Did you
publicly
think it was a bit too low status for in regards to what you'd, because I feel like that sometimes I'm like, I've done all of this beautiful shit where I've like spent a lot of time, like, and the idea of then having like an RX 100 point and shoot camera and using that feels like I've taken a bit of a step back.
Yeah, but I think you can actually do it in a way that's beautiful. And I have learned a lot just about vlogging and turning the camera on myself about how to make it look better. And I think I still want to actually employ my own, the similar style of filmmaking. So integrating voiceovers, a nice color grade, getting actual B-roll instead of just having everything be talking head, and not using a cheap camera, to use the Sony a7 R2. So the quality is still there. And I mean, I've learned a lot just about filmmaking in general from it. And I feel like they're getting to the point where they're good enough where I could put them on my YouTube channel, which makes me be like, oh, damn. Like that could be easy content.
Yeah.
But then I see the value. Somebody actually asked me that on Patreon. They said, do you feel like an extra hurdle or challenge in knowing that if you put this video on your YouTube channel, it may get 50,000 views, but when you put it on Patreon, you get 50 views. Mm. And I was like, you guys paid my bills last month. Yeah, so yeah. I can make videos for you all day long.
Yeah.
And I think that is it. It's the mindset of, you even said this with like the Seth Godin model, where it's like, what's the smallest audience that you could have that you could make a living from?
Yeah.
And that's what Patreon is really allowing you to do if you're thoughtful and you make really high quality content for it. But it just requires you to make more stuff.
When I started my video stuff, I was like, I'll get everything. Twitter, YouTube, Vimeo, Facebook page, you know.
LinkedIn,
yeah. And
Tommy's actually quite big on LinkedIn.
Yeah, yeah. No, you've mentioned it before. Yeah. And I was like, I don't even have a LinkedIn.
Yeah, and I've looked. You don't have a Facebook page?
I think I made my personal one private and then deleted my public one recently.
Yeah, and so have you thought, like, specific to a platform? Is that your whole intention? I'm being very focused on this.
It happened. I mean, the one thing is,
should I get rid of my LinkedIn is what I'm saying.
I think so. I mean, no, it really depends on it. It goes back to the reactive thing and reacting to what's working and what's not. And nobody liked anything on Facebook. And if I'm getting 0.001% of interactions on Facebook, I think it actually hurts and it just looks bad. Because if I'm reaching out to a big guest and like the first thing they happen to find is my Facebook page,
yeah,
and they're like, oh, only 1,000 people follow him, like, and nobody's commenting or interacting with him, it may look bad. It's also a mental strain. It's almost like a little bit of a weight where you know it's there. And even if you don't spend a whole lot of time posting to it or interacting on it, it is going to take up a certain amount, way too much time for what you're getting out of it. So I've tried to be very specific of most of my energy will go into YouTube and podcast. And then if I don't have those first set off, then I can't do newsletter, Instagram, Twitter.
Mm. What have you learned from doing the podcast that you've been able to bring across to video making, filmmaking?
I think it's
videographer.
Videography. yeah, as my mom would say. Doing long form content helps to break down the walls and the persona that people sometimes try to put on camera. So you try to be the person, hey, everybody. My brother always make fun of me because I was always like, I could do that like on camera. But hey, guys, what's going on? Welcome back to my YouTube channel. And he's like, it's so annoying, Matt. But you start to lose that. You lose this personality and trying to look good for people, which it just never looks good. It never feels authentic.
No.
And people react to you being yourself and you being comfortable. So I think when you do our 2-hour podcasts and you do over 80 of them, it starts to allow you just to be more comfortable on camera.
I like that meeting you not knowing you and meeting you in person, you're very similar, you're consistent, which is, it's different being like an actor. I think about meeting Tom Cruise. Who the hell is that guy? He plays so many different people. And I think, let's bring The Rock up. The Rock seems like he will be, he seems like he's nailed the consistency across everything he does. You could probably tell who that bloke is.
You are like The Rock.
Do I like The Rock? Do you guys think that I like The Rock?
Yeah, you are like The Rock.
Oh, I'm like The Rock.
Yeah.
Wow.
Consistent. You know what you're going to get.
Biceps.
Can you guys put that in writing? Okay, that's going to be my, I'm going to have to use that when I get him on the podcast.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You have a photo of The Rock on the wall in this room.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. He's got his fanny pack on.
Yeah,
otherwise known as a bum bag in Australia.
We call it a bum bag.
It's a leather palm bag.
What is
bum
that? What?
Bag. Bum bag. Sorry, I thought you called it a palm bag.
Palm
bag.
You say fanny pack.
Fanny pack.
Fanny pack.
Leather fanny pack. He's got a turtleneck and then a gold chain. It's amazing. Actually, he tweeted at me twice.
Yeah, that's cool.
And you lost your mind.
Oh, I lost it. So I've been, for the past 2 years, I've been trying to get him on the podcast. And it started out, it was way funnier when nobody listened to the podcast because like nobody listens to it. Now, I mean, it's still laughable that he would come on the show just because I recorded out of my dining room. Why would The Rock ever want to come on my podcast? But I just wanted to have a crazy stretch goal of, and something that people could follow along with. And like, it'd be a reoccurring theme on the show. Just what are the creative ways that I could come up with to potentially get The Rock's attention?
People are supportive.
Yeah,
I've noticed.
Yeah, no, it's actually one of the most common things that people will comment in a podcast or on Twitter. I have a big tweet button on, there's a website, it's called gettherockonmattspodcast.com, as well as a hashtag, hashtag gettherockonmattspodcast. But there's a big tweet button on the site. So people will go there and it's almost like interactive. You can click on it. And every time you click on it, it creates a new tweet for The Rock.
That's great.
And so your fiance, Natalie, is Australian.
Yeah.
What have you learned about Australians?
That's a great question. I didn't know. I had met one Australian before Natalie. Yeah.
Really?
And now I know way too many. I feel like, well, you guys just like, even if you're in America, you just find each other and there's like these little alcoves and clusters. We went to London. I forget where we were staying, but it was just everybody in the block was Australian.
If you want good coffee, you just hang around an Australian.
This is a point of contention between Natalie and myself. Because she will often say, I mean, Americans, they don't know coffee. They're terrible with coffee. But my experience has been the opposite, at least lately in the past 5 years. I mean, especially if you're living in LA or New York, there's just a great local indie coffee shop and roaster around every corner.
But half of the baristas are fucking Australian. Haven't you worked that out?
It's heavily leaning.
PCP, like you've got the, PCP is it?
Yeah.
The coffee shop, Australian.
Yep.
That one's nearby.
Coffee, right here.
Are they Australian? Yeah. The barista was.
Yeah.
So it does lean.
There's something there. But so I would say that, like, definitely middle America is Dunkin'. America runs on Dunkin'.
I think Starbucks. We're adopting some of the American coffee culture in terms of like that really cheap, quick
shit.
I haven't drank. I haven't had a latte since being here. Like a strong latte is what I get home because I'm like, I'm going straight for that just big vat of coffee that I can just drink lots of.
It's an interesting point though, because I think this is where I think that we do coffee a little bit differently. In Australia, I don't know if they have yet, but they haven't adopted the pour over method, like the drip coffee where it's like artisan drip coffee. But you guys do have the lattes and the cappuccinos.
I think we're known for the flat whites and things like that. But there is a bit like the hipster culture, especially in Collingwood where our office is. There's a lot of that. There's a coffee shop, Aunt Peg's, which we took Josh and Ryan to. And that's a only black coffee. They do no milk. They literally don't have milk on the premises. You ask for milk and their beards do this like weird like movement.
It's super
thing.
Expensive.
They like shrivel
though.
Up.
Yeah,
exactly. It's really weird.
As a Melbourneite, I haven't gone to any of these places because it's too expensive and it's, I don't know.
$5 for a cup of coffee is a lot of money. And that's what it usually, it's $5 or $6.
Yeah.
And then you like, you know, you got a tip. $7, $8 for a cup of coffee.
Oh,
it's kind of crazy.
Nah, it's outrageous. And so, yeah, the whole tipping thing has been has been its own beast.
But the tipping is a whole other story. But Australians in general, what have I learned?
Yeah.
I feel like, they very much don't take themselves too seriously, not easily offended.
Yeah.
But can offend the world. You know what I mean? Like you see them on the news every once in a while, like, Australia just won't learn. And it's like, I don't know. I'd rather be with like the Aussies who just making fun of themselves and other people. And I don't know. There's a bit like the PC culture in America has definitely gone a little bit too far.
Yeah. Do you think that you would ever live in Australia or when you visit Australia, is there anything that you try and take back to the way you live here in the States?
I think that Australia's become a second home to me, and I think it's always going to be a place that, I mean, in an ideal world, it's funny, like being a minimalist, but likely we'll have, I want to have like a home in Australia where we can actually go and spend either half the year there mm-hmm. or like months there at a time.
Bree would be wrapped because she was saying the other day, she's like, man, if Matt and Nat lived in Australia, it'd be so good.
Well,
so
we got to get you guys to move to Sydney.
Yeah, this is going to be the content. Maybe we move to Canberra. It's in the middle.
Halfway.
No, yeah. No, don't. Do not.
It's not much there.
Nothing.
They've got like the parliament.
Or we just go like the outback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or we could do like Byron Bay or something, but that's just gotten too expensive.
Sydney's a great option. By the water in Sydney's crazy.
Yeah. Can't beat it.
I mean, or you could come to Melbourne and beat it.
Yeah. Sydney's easier, I think. I don't know. Is Melbourne, is there a lot of direct flights?
Yeah, there is.
I'd have to look into it.
Yeah. But we could definitely make something worth work. So you, so that's what you've learned about Australia is it's the...
We're legends.
We're a bit outrageous at times.
Good people. People in America love your fucking accents.
Yeah.
That was actually one thing Nat got really upset early on because I didn't say anything. Because like she, everybody, even like my mom is just like, I could just listen to you talk all day.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but she's saying dumb shit. like she's not even being intelligent.
Well, America's
the bar is so low.
It's so big. I remember driving through parts and speaking to locals and they were fascinated by my accent because they hadn't met an Australian. It's like this country is massive and there's so many people here.
Oh yeah. If you're outside of a major city and like that was one thing that she would always expect somebody if we're in Jersey where I grew up, like in a small town. And she just waits. She gets upset if a barista doesn't say, hey, oh, where are you from?
Yeah. We should, our strategy just to get this podcast out there, go to all over America, inland.
Yeah.
Just very, the deep south.
Well, do you think we could create an audience in the States? Do you think there is an appetite for two Australians talking or do you think we're just a little bit too removed?
I don't know. I think so. That is interesting though, because even when you look at Hamish and Andy and it's like massive in Australia and I only know about them because of Natalie.
Yeah.
And do they have much of an audience in America? I mean, it probably does stretch.
I think it's like third on the list. I think it's like Australia, UK, the US. And they've done a bunch of, they did a show, like a night show for Leonard. They did it for the Australian audience. Oh, yeah. I was going to say outside of New York, in New York. Specifically for the Australian audience. So they've done heaps of stuff.
They were on Jay Leno, which is huge.
Oh, they were.
That's amazing. That would have got them a few fans.
Yeah. Because I do wonder about that sort of stuff. As we go, there's more globalization around the world. Like what does that mean for content creators, people doing stuff?
Yeah. I mean, my audience, at least on YouTube, and I think even in the podcast, is 50% United States. Mm. And then the other 50% is the rest of the world.
Australia would be up there. I would guess.
Australia. It's like UK, Australia, Canada. Mm-hmm. And like those are the top four. But then you have Germany and it just gets obviously smaller and smaller. But it is interesting to see 50% of my audience. If I was just in America and that's all I could only connect with, it would be much smaller. Mm-hmm. And I do get surprised the fact that there are people in Germany that listen to it.
Yeah. What do you think is the bit that having listened to a little bit of our show, what do you think wouldn't connect with, say, a US audience versus what might connect with a US
audience? The C word.
Offensive.
The C word.
No, I mean, I think that there's, the more that I've gotten just to known Aussies in general and you guys, it's that there's really not much different.
Mm.
I think it would be interesting to like be able to learn about somebody else's culture. And like as similar as we are, the only gap is going to be getting over the isms and the vocabulary that Aussies use that nobody else in the world uses.
Yeah.
You got to end at O on every word. Bottle O. It's not a thing anywhere else.
Yeah, that's funny. Do you get our accents? Like, is this something that we would have to struggle with here?
I don't think so. I mean, it's hard because with Nat, I feel like I've kind of... You pick up on it, but it is interesting because even like hearing Bree talk, it takes a little while because it's a distinct accent, but it's also a distinct voice and you get to know that person's voice with the accent. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it does.
But for me, it's like Josh, I've heard you talk so much that it's just easier for me to pick up what you're saying.
Yeah.
Talking too much is just such a pain point with him. I'm triggered. No, I think Brie has been, whenever we travel, I think people struggle with Brie more. They understand what I'm saying. I don't know. Maybe it's because I listen to so much American content. Or yeah, Brie might sound like a bit of a bogan.
I definitely notice the differences in our accents, Josh, Brie and me, when we're here. And I do think you're bogan accent, Brie.
But Tommy's also a bit bogan.
Me too.
Do you think, like, hearing Tommy and I speak, would you be able to pick that Tommy's Australian, do you think, before me? Or what's your take on our accents?
The bogan meter is what Josh is saying. Which one's higher?
Yeah, probably Tommy is like higher in the bogan meter.
Fuck yeah, mate.
Josh is so goddamn sophisticated.
it's the glasses.
And the turtleneck you've got on. Yeah,
there's no turtleneck. I don't know,
that's a subtle turtleneck.
It's too hot in Los Angeles for a turtleneck. Matt Diavela, mate, thanks so much for being on The Daily Talk Show. And I'm looking forward to this idea of you just fucking coming to Australia.
Yeah.
We can pot out with our...
It's party.
I was going to say pot out with our cocks out. Is that the saying?
We can do that.
Yeah, I mean, great.
It's next part episode, of your culture.
Maybe it could be our next...
Nudie runs.
Our first live show.
Looking forward to having you back on, mate.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks, guys.
Have a good one.
See you, guys.
Bye.